This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Love and Its Meaning in the World. This is part 11, a lecture given on December 17, 1912 in Zurich, entitled Love and Its Meaning in the World. When we say that at this point in human evolution, people must come to understand the Christ principle, we may ask, what then is the situation for those who have never heard of the Christ impulse and may have never even heard the name of Christ? Will such people be deprived of the Christ impulse because they have not heard the name of Christ? Is it necessary to have some theoretical knowledge of the Christ impulse for Christ's power to flow into the soul? We will become clear about these questions by the following thoughts concerning human life from birth until death. Human beings come into the world and live through early childhood half asleep. Gradually they must learn to experience themselves as I, to find their bearings as I beings, and enrich their soul life constantly by what is received through the I. By the time death approaches, this soul life is richest and ripest. Hence the vital question, what about our soul life after the body falls away? It is peculiar to our physical and soul life that the wealth of our experience and knowledge increases in significance the nearer we approach death. But at the same time, certain attributes are lost and replaced by others of an entirely different character. During our youth, we gather knowledge, pass through experiences, cherish hopes that, as a rule, can only later be fulfilled. As we grow older, we begin more and more to love the wisdom revealed by life. Love of wisdom is not egoistic, for this love increases as we approach death. As our expectation of gaining something through wisdom decreases, wisdom increases. Our love for this content of soul steadily increases. In this sense, spiritual science may in fact become a source of temptation to the degree that a person may come to believe that the next life will depend on acquiring wisdom in the present one. The effect of spiritual science may be an extension of egoism beyond the bounds of the present life, and this is the danger. Consequently, when understood in the wrong way, spiritual science may become a tempter. This is there in its very nature. Love of wisdom acquired from life may be compared to the flowering of a plant at the proper stage of maturity. Love arises for something within ourselves. Human beings have often tried to sublimate the impulse of love for something within themselves. We find evidence, for example, of mystics who attempted to transform the urge toward self-love into the love of wisdom, and to let this love shine out in beauty. By sinking through contemplation into the depths of their own soul life, they worked for awareness of the divine spark within themselves. The truth, however, is that the wisdom one acquires in life is merely the means to unfold the seed of the next life. When a plant has completed its growth through the year, the seed remains, and this is also true of the wisdom acquired from life. A human being passes through the gate of death, and the ripening process of the spiritual core of its being is the seed of the next life. Those who feel this may become mystics and mistake what is only the seed of the next life for the divine spark, or absolute. This is their interpretation, because it goes against the grain for human beings to acknowledge that this spirit seed is simply their own self. Because they knew nothing of reincarnation, Meister Eckhart, John Tauler, and others spoke of it as the God within. When we understand the significance of the law of reincarnation, we recognize the purpose of love in the world, both in a particular and in a general sense. When we speak of karma, we mean the cause in the one life that affects the next. Nevertheless, we cannot truly speak of love in terms of cause and effect. We cannot speak of an act of love and its eventual compensation. True, if there is an action, there will be compensation, but this has nothing to do with love itself. Acts of love do not look for compensation in the next life. Imagine, for example, that we work, and this leads to gain. It may also happen that our work gives us no joy, since we do it merely to pay our debts, not for actual reward. We can imagine that in this way we have already spent what we are now earning through our work. We would prefer to have no debts, but as things stand, we are obliged to work in order to pay them. Now let us apply this example to our actions in general. By everything we do out of love, we pay off debts. From an esoteric point of view, what is done out of love brings no reward, but makes amends for profit already expended. The only actions from which we have nothing in the future are those we perform out of true, genuine love. This truth may well be disquieting, and human beings are lucky in that they know nothing of it in their upper consciousness. But in their subconsciousness, all of them know it. And that is why acts of love are done so unwillingly, why there is so little love in the world. Human beings feel instinctively that they may expect nothing for their I in the future from acts of love. An advanced stage of development must be reached before the soul can experience joy in performing acts of love from which there is nothing to be gained for itself. The impulse for this is not strong in humankind, but esotericism can be a source of powerful incentives for acts of love. Our egoism gains nothing from acts of love, but the world gains all the more. Esotericism tells us that love is to the world what the sun is for outer life. No soul could thrive if love departed from the world. Love is the moral sun of the world. Would it not be absurd if a person who delights in the flowers growing in a meadow were to wish that the sun would vanish from the world? Translated into terms of the moral life, this means that our deep concern must be that an impulse for sound, healthy development shall find its way into human affairs. To disseminate love over the earth in the greatest measure possible, to promote love on the earth, that and that alone is wisdom. What do we learn from spiritual science? We learn about the evolution of the earth. We hear of the spirit of the earth's surface and its changing conditions, the development of the human body, and so on. We come to understand the nature of the forces working and weaving in the evolutionary process. What does this mean? What does it mean when people do not want to know anything about spiritual science? It means that they have no interest in reality. For one can know nothing about the earth if there is no desire to know anything about the nature of old sun, old Saturn, old moon. Lack of interest in the world is egoism in its grossest form. Interest in all existence is humanity's duty. Let us therefore long for and love the sun with its creative power, its love for the well-being of the earth and the souls of human beings. This interest in the earth's evolution should be the spiritual seed of love for the world. A spiritual science without love would be a danger to humankind. But love should not be a matter for preaching. Love must, and indeed will, come into the world through the spreading of knowledge of spiritual truths. Acts of love and spiritual science should be inseparably united. Love mediated by the senses is the wellspring of creative power, of what is coming into being. Without sense-born love, nothing material would exist in the world. Without spiritual love, nothing spiritual can arise in evolution. When we practice love, cultivate love, creative forces pour into the world. Can the intellect be expected to offer reasons for this? The creative forces poured into the world before we ourselves and our intellect came into being. True, as egoists, we can deprive the future of creative forces. But we cannot obliterate the acts of love in the creative forces of the past. We owe our existence to acts of love done in the past. The strength with which we have been endowed by these acts of love is the measure of our deep debt to the past, and whatever love we may at any time be able to bring forth is payment of debts owed for our existence. In the light of this knowledge, we will be able to understand the actions of those who have reached a high stage of development, for they have still greater debts to pay to the past. They pay their debts through acts of love, and herein lies their wisdom. The higher the stage of development reached by human beings, the more the impulse of love in them increases in strength. Wisdom alone does not suffice. Let us think of the meaning and effect of love in the world in the following way. Love is always a reminder of debts owed to life in the past, and because we gain nothing for the future by paying off these debts, no profit for ourselves accrues from our acts of love. We have to leave our acts of love behind in the world, but they are then a spiritual factor in the flow of world events. It is not through our acts of love, but through acts of a different character that we perfect ourselves. Yet the world is richer for our acts of love. Love is the creative force in the world. Besides love, there are two other powers in the world. How do they compare with love? One is strength, might. The other is wisdom. In regard to strength, or might, we can speak of degrees. Weaker, stronger, or absolute might, omnipotence. The same applies to wisdom, for there are stages on the path to omniscience. It will not do to speak in the same way of degrees of love. What is universal love? Love for all beings. In the case of love, we cannot speak of enhancement as we can speak of enhancement of knowledge into omniscience or of might into omnipotence, by virtue of which we attain greater perfection of our own being. Love for a few or for many beings has nothing to do with our own perfecting. Love for everything that lives cannot be compared with omnipotence. The concept of magnitude or of enhancement cannot rightly be applied to love. Can the attribute of omnipotence be ascribed to the divine being who lives and weaves through the world? Contentions born of feeling must here be silent. Were God omnipotent, he would be responsible for everything that happens, and there could be no human freedom. If human beings can be free, then certainly there can be no divine omnipotence. Is the Godhead omniscient? Since our highest goal is likeness to God, our striving must be in the direction of omniscience. Is omniscience then the supreme treasure? If it is, a vast chasm must forever yawn between human beings and God. If the Godhead possessed the supreme treasure of omniscience for itself and withheld it from us, we would have to be aware of that chasm at every moment. The all-encompassing attribute of the Godhead is not omnipotence, nor is it omniscience. It is love, the attribute that cannot be enhanced. God is uttermost love, unalloyed love, is born, as it were, out of love, is the very substance and essence of love. God is pure love, not supreme wisdom, not supreme might. God has retained love for himself, but has shared wisdom and might with Lucifer and Ahriman. He has shared wisdom with Lucifer and might with Ahriman, so that human beings may become free, so that under the influence of wisdom they may progress. If we try to find the source of anything creative, we arrive at love. Love is the ground, the foundation of everything alive. It is a different impulse in evolution that leads beings to greater wisdom and power. We make progress through wisdom and strength. When we study the course of human evolution, we see how the development of wisdom and strength is subject to change. There is evolutionary progress. and then the Christ impulse poured once into humankind through the mystery of Golgotha. Love did not come into the world by degrees. It flowed into humanity as a gift of the Godhead, completely and perfectly whole. Nevertheless, we can receive that impulse into ourselves gradually. The divine impulse of love, as we need it in earthly life, is an impulse that came once and forever. True love is incapable of reduction or amplification. It is very different from wisdom and power. Love does not awaken expectations of the future. It is payment of past debts. Such was the mystery of Golgotha in world evolution. Did the Godhead then owe any debt to humanity? Lucifer's influence introduced a certain element into human beings. The result was to remove something we had possessed previously. This new element led to a descent. The mystery of Golgotha countered that and made possible the payment of all debts. The impulse of Golgotha was not intended to remove the sins we have committed in evolution, but to counterbalance what crept into humanity through Lucifer. Imagine that there are people who know nothing of the name of Jesus Christ, nothing of what is communicated in the Gospels, but who understand the radical difference between the nature of wisdom and might and the nature of love. Such people, even though they know nothing of the mystery of Golgotha, are Christians in the truest sense. A person who knows that love is there to pay debts and brings no profit for the future is a true Christian. To understand the nature of love, that is to be a Christian. Theosophy or spiritual science alone, with its teachings of karma and reincarnation, can make us into great egoists unless the impulse of love, the Christ impulse, is added. Only in this way can we acquire the power to overcome the egoism that may be generated by spiritual science. The balance is established by an understanding of the Christ impulse. Spiritual science is given to the world today because it is a necessity for humankind. But it contains the great danger that if it is cultivated without the Christ impulse, without the impulse of love, human beings will only increase their egoism, will actually breed egoism that lasts even beyond death. We must not conclude from this that we should not cultivate spiritual science. Rather, we must learn to realize that understanding of the essential nature of love is an integral part of it. What occurred with the mystery of Golgotha? Jesus of Nazareth was born, lived as related in the Gospels, and when he was 30 years old, he was baptized in the Jordan. Thereafter, the Christ lived for 3 years in the body of Jesus of Nazareth and fulfilled the mystery of Golgotha. Many believe that the mystery of Golgotha should be considered entirely from the human aspect, since they view it as an earthly act belonging to the realm of earth. But that is not true. Only from the vantage point of the higher worlds is it possible to see the mystery of Golgotha in its true light and how it came to pass on the earth. Let us think again of the beginning of the evolution of the earth and humankind. Human beings were endowed with certain spiritual powers, and then Lucifer approached them. We can say that at this point, the gods who furthered the progress of evolution surrendered their omnipotence to Lucifer so that humankind might become free. The human beings sank into matter more deeply than was intended. They slipped away from the gods of progress, fell more deeply than had been wished. How then can the gods of progress draw humankind to themselves again? To understand this, we must not think of earth, but of gods taking counsel together. It is for the gods that Christ performs the act through which human beings are drawn back to the gods. Lucifer's deed was enacted in the supersensible world. Christ's deed was enacted in the supersensible world and in the physical world. This achievement is beyond the power of any human being. Lucifer's act belongs to the supersensible world, But Christ came down to the earth to perform his act here, and people are observers at that deed. The mystery of Golgotha is an action of the gods, a concern of the gods, at which human beings are the onlookers. The door of heaven opens, and an act of the gods shines through. This is the one and only deed on earth that is entirely supersensible. No wonder, therefore, that those who do not believe in the supersensible have no belief in Christ's deed. The act of Christ is a deed of the gods, an act that they themselves enact. Herein lies the glory and the unique significance of the mystery of Golgotha, and human beings are invited to be its witnesses. Historical evidence is not to be found. Humans have seen the event in its external aspect only. But the Gospels were written from vision of the supersensible, and are, therefore, easily disavowed by those who have no feeling for supersensible reality. The mystery of Golgotha, as an accomplished fact, is one of the most sublime of all experiences in the spiritual world. Lucifer's deed belongs to a time when human beings were still aware of their own participation in the supersensible world. Christ's deed was performed in material existence itself. It is both a physical and a spiritual action. We can understand the deed of Lucifer through wisdom. Understanding of the mystery of Golgotha is beyond the reach of wisdom alone. Even if all the wisdom of this world is ours, the deed of Christ may still be beyond our comprehension. Love is essential for any understanding of the mystery of Golgotha. Only when love streams into wisdom, and then again wisdom flows into love, will it be possible to grasp the nature and meaning of the mystery of Golgotha. Only when, as they live on toward death, human beings unfold love of wisdom. Love united with wisdom, that is what we need when we pass through the gate of death. Because without wisdom that is united with love, we die in very truth. Philosophy is love of wisdom. The ancient wisdom was not philosophy, for it was not born through love, but through revelation. There is no such thing as philosophy of the East, but wisdom of the East, yes. Philosophy as love of wisdom came into the world with Christ. There we have the entry of wisdom, emanating from the impulse of love that came into the world as the Christ impulse. The impulse of love must now be carried into effect in wisdom itself. The ancient wisdom acquired by the seer through revelation is expressed in the sublime words from the original prayer of humankind, Ex Deo nascimur, out of God we are born. That is ancient wisdom. Christ, who came forth from the realms of spirit, has united wisdom with love, and this love will overcome egoism. Such is its aim. But it must be offered independently and freely from one being to the other. Hence the beginning of the era of love coincided with the beginning of the era of egoism. The cosmos has its source and origin in love. Egoism was the natural and inevitable offshoot of love. Yet with time, the Christ impulse, the impulse of love, will overcome the element of separation that has crept into the world, and the human being can gradually become a participant in this force of love. In monumental words of Christ, we feel love pouring into the hearts of human beings, quote, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them, unquote. In like manner, the ancient Rosicrucian saying resounds into the love that is wedded with wisdom, In Christo morimur, in Christ we die. Through Jehovah, human beings were predestined for a group soul existence. Love was to penetrate into them gradually through blood relationship. It is through Lucifer that the human being lives as a personality. Originally, therefore, human beings were in a state of union, then of separateness as a consequence of the Luciferic principle that promotes selfishness, independence. Together with selfishness, evil came into the world. It had to be so, because without the evil, human beings could not lay hold of the good. When human beings gain victory over themselves, the unfolding of love is possible. Christ brought the impulse for this victory to humans in the clutches of increasing egoism and thereby the power to conquer evil. The acts of Christ bring together again the human beings who were separated through egoism and selfishness. The words of Christ concerning acts of love are true in the very deepest sense. Quote, "Inasmuch as you have done it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you have done it to me." Unquote. The divine act of love flowed back upon the earth. As time goes on, in spite of the forces of physical decay and death, the evolution of humankind will be permeated and imbued with new spiritual life through this act, a deed performed not out of egoism, but solely out of the spirit of love, per spiritum sanctum revivissimus, through the Holy Spirit we live again. Yet the future of humanity will consist of something besides love. Spiritual perfecting will be, for earthly human beings, the most worthy goal to aspire to. This is described at the beginning of my second mystery drama, titled The Soul's Probation. But none who understands what acts of love truly are will say that their own striving for perfection is selfless. Striving for perfection imparts strength to our being and to our personality. But our value for the world must be seen to lie wholly in acts of love, not in what is done for the sake of self-perfecting. Let us be under no illusion about this. When a person is endeavoring to follow Christ through love of wisdom and dedicates that wisdom to the service of the world, it only takes real effect to the extent it is filled with love. Wisdom steeped in love, which at once furthers the world and leads the world to Christ. This love of wisdom also excludes the lie. For the lie is the direct opposite of the actual facts, and those who yield themselves lovingly to the facts are incapable of lying. The lie has its roots in egoism, always and without exception. When, through love, we have found the path to wisdom, we reach wisdom through the increasing power of self-conquest, through selfless love. In this way, the human being becomes a free individuality. The evil was the subsoil into which the light of love was able to shine. But it is love that enables us to grasp the meaning and place of evil in the world. The darkness has enabled the light to come into our ken. Only a person who is free in the real sense can become a true Christian. The end of part 11.